Hello, respected viewers. It's George from Ireland. So here I'm at in Hampstead, London, in front of Capo di Monte, a house as in head of the hill, because it's more or less on top of Hampstead Hill, just beside Hampstead Park. What should I say? Hampstead Common. And there's a little place called Judge's Walk. I was trying to find it via Judge's Walk, because if you look here, Judge's Walk, it really is a walk. I'd assumed it was going to be a street, but that's it down there. It's a somewhat muddy footpath, but thankfully, coming in high summer, it's not too muddy. So I was telling you about Capo di Monte, mainly because of his distinguished residence. Well, it's the Honourable Alan Clark, who's fascinated me since adolescence. Thank you, Dr. Sheard, my tutor, for introducing me to him, watching Love Tory in the mid-90s, a couple of years after it came out, that documentary about him. So, and of course, his very distinguished father, Lord Clark, commonly called Lord Clark of Civilization. But I'll stick with my Clark, who was born, if memory serves, the 23rd of April, 1928. So born in London, at Lancaster Gate. He's Irish on his mother's side, Scots on his father's side. But he owned an estate in Scotland later on, an arable. So far as I know, he never actually went to Ireland, but didn't mention being Irish very much. But he came from a very distinguished lineage. His maternal grandmother had been one of the first women to qualify as a physician in Ireland. His great-grandfather was a Liberal MP, as indeed was his great-great-grandfather. So they both came from Ulster. His mother was born in Dublin. So on his father's side, his great-great-grandfather, if I got that right, had made a fortune in Paisley, North Britain, in wool and thread and stuff like that. So yeah, coming back to this Capo di Monte house. But anyway, Alan Kenneth Mackenzie Clark, taking the middle names from his father. So he went to a prep school in Marylebone, then St. Cyprian School, Eastbourne. That's where indeed George Orwell had been a generation earlier, because Orwell was born 1904, if I got that right. And then Ken Clark was there in May 1939 when the school burnt down. It was later relocated to Midhurst in Sussex. So he had twins 4 years younger than him, Colin and Colette. Colette, always known as Kelly, who he didn't always get along with. But Alan Clark, he went to Cheltenham Junior School for Cheltenham College in the war to be a bit safer, then to Eton in the Second World War. He was there in 1946. He was in Mr. Jakes's house. Now that housemaster, his son, another Mr. Jakes, Nigel Jakes, NJTJ, he was a housemaster even until 1993. Is that when he stood down? Yeah. And I knew him somewhat, a very tall, bald, classic speak, Hattie Jakes, who was jocularly known as, in reference to the famous actress Hattie Jakes. That name was spelled J-A-Q-U-E-S. It's a Huguenot name. I always thought it was pronounced Jacques when I initially saw it, but it's not. It's got no C in the middle, with the French name would. Alan Clark and his housemaster did not get along terribly well. He was no great shakes at games, not that academically distinguished, and everybody had to join the officer training corps, as in do military training. One afternoon a week, the Second World War was on. They had to spend some nights in the bomb shelter. But actually, Eton was scarcely bombed because Adolf Hitler gave the Luftwaffe an exclusion zone around Windsor Castle, saying that when he conquered Great Britain, the castle would be his personal residence. Well, that didn't happen. Now, of course, navigation was very primitive in those days. Some planes went astray. I mean, put it this way, planes bound from Belfast managed to bomb Dublin. They got it that badly wrong, only 200 kilometres off course. But Eton got off relatively lightly. I mean, at least one bomb fell. That's more of Capo di Monte. So Alan Clark, his family were very distinguished. His father was good friends of King George V, which is why his father was knighted at the age of 35, was director of the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square at the age of 30. So his parents, they were always having affairs with other people, but I don't think anyone doubts the paternity of Alan or his younger twin sister and brother. So what else about Alan Clark? So he was in the Household Cavalry Training Regiment. He joined on his 18th birthday. He later used to lie and claimed he joined when he was 17. So he was only in it for about 4 months, from sort of February till June 1946. But those were the days of national service. Even after the Second World War, boys had to do 2 years in the armed forces unless they had some sort of medical dispensation. I have wondered about ultra-Orthodox Jews because say, well, you have to shave your beard and your side locks and we won't give you kosher food. I'm not aware of any of them having to serve. Obviously, secular Jewish men served. You could delay it, go to university first and do it afterwards. But somehow, his 4 months very part-time in the household cavalry counted, because there was that guards barracks in Windsor about 2 miles from Eton. Bizarrely, as a schoolboy, I didn't even know where it was. It was not until a few years ago in coronavirus, cycling around Windsor, I found out where it was. I really only knew around the castle, Pescud Street. And people say that he also told, sort of applied to join the Royal Air Force, and somehow he fooled the system and he got out of it. He went up to Christchurch, Oxford, to read history. So that was the grandest college of all, with the most blue-blooded undergraduates, boys only in those days. Despite him not being that brilliant academically, he obviously passes responsions in maths, history and Latin and ancient Greek, not in history itself. But it wasn't that difficult to get in to Oxford University in those days. It is not true you could be a complete dunderhead and get in. That is a myth. And it wasn't that easy to graduate. Certainly with a high-class degree, first-class degree was the best, then second-class. There was no 2-1, 2-2 distinction to the 60s. Third-class degree, or indeed a fourth, a gentleman's fourth. Below that, well, a fail. So they say, you either want a first or a fourth. Time spent on a good second is time thrown away. But he managed to get a third. Hugh Trevor Roper, the very distinguished historian, later peer, was his tutor. He was fascinated by automobiles always. Upon going down from Christchurch, what would he do with himself? He reviewed cars and things like that. He was given allowance from his father, and I thought it would be of extraordinary liberality, but it wasn't actually. It's more or less equivalent to the modern minimum wage, because his father knew that he'd be a complete wastrel if he didn't have to work for a living. So gave him enough to as a subvention, so he could have something like a decent lifestyle on the rather precarious income of a journalist. It wasn't just as appalling as it is these days. Of course, people are actually into reading and purchasing publications. It's not like now, when people expect to get it for free or just don't read very much. And he played the stock market and so on. He dated this dancer from Yorkshire. What was her name? Was it Margaret Ball? But he impregnated her when she was 19. She had an abortion because a sort of expensive psychiatrist in Harley Street certified her medically unfit to be a mother or something like that. There's completely dubious, nonsensical grounds for the murder of Clark's own child. Now, in fairness to him, he was conscience-stricken about that. He felt guilty about that for the rest of his life. How much was his doing, I'm not sure. Now, because his girlfriend was only 19 at the time, she wasn't of legal majority. That was 21 back then. So she needed an adult to sign off on this. And Clark's mother did that. Well, imagine what this woman did to her own grandchild. Not uncommon, I'm afraid. So that relationship broke down. He never seemed to consider marrying this Yorkshire woman, who partly because I think she was working class and he was a crashing snob. Perhaps surprising he dated her. But much later on, when he was 28, he started dating Jane Boytle. I hope I pronounced it correct. Jane wasn't actually her real name. When he got married, he insisted she change her name to Jane, like Clark's own mother. Dating her at 14, he was 28. These days, we'd have a certain word for someone who does that. But they got married when she was 16, just 2 months after her birthday, with her parents' blessing. Her father's an army officer without serious means. She lived in all sorts of places like Saudi Arabia, what we now call Yemen. But 2 years later, they were blessed with a first son, James. Then the next one was Andrew, 2 years after that. The boys later went to Le Rosé in Switzerland, the most expensive school in the world. So yeah, Alan Clark. He started being a military historian, writing The Donkeys, which was really skewering the British top brass from the First World War. And it inspired that musical by Joan Littlewood, Oh, What a Lovely War, which is really a send-up of British strategy and supposedly the futility of war, writing about the Barbarossa, the Russian-German conflict. He should have actually said Soviet, of course, various other well-received terms like this, but it did rub some people off the wrong way. When he was a junior minister, the Ministry of Defence, some generals really disliked him because, of course, he had ridiculed their predecessors who had been there two generations earlier. What else about Clark? So he's only the late 60s considered going into politics, but he was very outspoken. He has made anti-Semitic remarks. I think he was playing it for laughs, very distastefully. Anthony Blonde, who was Jewish, was his friend at school. Now, obviously, very few Jewish boys at Eton, maybe like 2% of them. And his publisher, and he sort of, you know, went out of his way to actually be friendly with Jewish people. But you might think it was nauseating so soon after the Holocaust to be cracking jokes of that nature. What else did Clark do? So later got himself elected for Plymouth Sutton, 1974. He was a member of the Monday Club, and he was an outspoken admirer of Enoch Pearl, had nauseating views on race, saying that, you know, non-white people ought not be permitted to settle in the United Kingdom, and so forth. So it was very, very wealthy when his father died in 1983. His mother had died about 10 years earlier, but Clark really detested his stepmother, this French noblewoman. But then Alan Clark, he inherited Saltwood Castle in Kent, which his father purchased in 1953. His father's very, very well known by the 60s from his silly series on art, simply called Civilization. But there are obviously some BLMers say, oh, it's a white supremacist or something like that. His father was actually a Labour supporter. Anything else? Yeah, his brother was well known as being an assistant director in Hollywood films. There's that biopic about him, My Week with Marilyn, in which Eddie Redmayne plays him, and they visit Eton, just across the river from where something was being filmed in the 1950s. So Clark was very well known as a diarist. His diaries in the 60s take us through. He actually published a few novels in the 1950s, which I hadn't realised until I started perusing the Jan Truyen biography of Alan Clark. He's an absolutely scintillating figure. I mean, fast forward, I remember being shocked in my gap year reading about his death from a brain tumour on the 5th of September 1999. And his death was only announced after his burial. So he died at home in Saltwood Castle, and he was buried in a shroud, no coffin, very simply. He toyed with converting to Catholicism. Father Peter Seed, who was sort of father confessor to some Westminster Tories, had led him in religion, but Clark didn't cross the Tiber because he wasn't assured that his dogs could join him in heaven. He had announced he'd gone to join Tom and all the other dogs. So his castle's where that's where the men who murdered Thomas Becket had plotted their deed. I think that's where they even hid out the night after it. So that is Alan Clark, and his eldest son has certainly died. Both his sons wed. I mean, don't know how many grandchildren he's got. His good wife, Jane, she survives him, and she tolerated his endless infidelities. She said that some of his paramours were nice, and his infidelity began within hours of his marriage. I mean, God, even I think that's in for a dig. But anyway, that is Alan Clark. They don't make him like that anymore. That's an Alan Clark diary series came out around 2004, starring John Hurt, a leftist, who managed to give a sympathetic portrayal to this very complex man whose views were not entirely predictable, being a vegetarian, being an outspoken advocate of animal rights and so forth, having a completely contemptuous attitude to the very notion of human rights and so forth, simply wanting to bolster British arms sales no matter what are the consequences thereof. So that is Alan Clark. Thank you for watching the channel. Make sure you subscribe on PayPal, donate on Patreon. On PayPal, georgecallahan79@gmail.com. And by the way, the Clarks, after a while, they moved out of Capo de Monte and they bought this upper terrace house, which is behind me, but I can't show it to you because the wall is so high. It's much, much bigger. Yeah, and because as a Capo de Monte, I walked right past it up Judge's Walk looking for it. But I'll give you some sort of idea of the proportions of upper terrace house. So they were never short of a few pennies, so that they could have just been a gentleman of leisure. But Clark achieved something for himself with all his writings. So yeah, he was notable as a diarist, as indiscreet, as bitchy, as acerbic, as hilarious. But I knew Lord Butler of Brockwell, who was the master of my college, who had to read them and see they weren't revealing any national secrets or whatever, breaking the Official Secrets Act. And he said that though they were unputtownable, they were largely fictive. A lot of things didn't happen and the chronology didn't quite make sense, but they were written with a view to publication. But yeah, so he's the soul of indiscretion and perhaps the most notorious diarist of Samuel Pepys. One of the big differences, of course, Pepys's were not intended for publication, were written cryptically. We were unable to crack the code a couple hundred years after he died. Anyway, that is Upper Terrace House, where they lived originally. It'd be easier to see in winter when there wouldn't be all this foliage obscuring it. So you get some sort of idea of the proportions of Upper Terrace House. So a much, much bigger. Okay, so thank you for joining me in Hampstead. I had to walk all the way up to Hampstead Hill. He was always fascinated by planes, and he liked it to étape le bourgeois. Spoke very good French, fairly good German, some Russian. Had been to the World Youth Festival in Moscow in 1957, which was really a communist front thing. People say, was he doing a job for MI5? Look at that. That is Upper Terrace House. You've got some idea. Okay, thank you everyone. Bye-bye.